You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator. It's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. So today I want you to imagine that you started out your life thinking about being a writer. And so much of your life was focused on, back then, writing stories, telling stories, sharing your experiences in unique and interesting ways. And then having your life sort of sidelined by the needs to earn a living, and finally having that life really come back to you when the stories in you sort of call you back to something that you loved as a child, and you take it on with a real vigor and interest and skill and excellence. Well, that is the story of our guest today. Karen E. Osborne was that little girl who wanted to be a writer when she was in grade school, and life got in the way and she became an administrator, actually a development professional for colleges and universities, raised lots of money, helped them raise lots of money, and then started a consultancy where she helped organizations thrive and also share with them different trainings that they needed in order to make sure that their professionals were great. But then the calling came. She says it was a character who is a protagonist in her first novel, Kara. And she's been writing novels since. She has a new novel that's out and another one that will be coming out in 2022. We'll get a chance to talk about those. But we'll also get to talk with Karen about development. You know, one of the key areas for all nonprofits is the ability to raise money. And Karen knows how to raise money. So we're going to talk with her about that. We're also going to talk with her about how important it is that nonprofits engage the right types of consultants for different things that they need. And Karen certainly has some experience with that. We're obviously going to talk about how she transitioned from a nonprofit professional to a novelist. And also, you know, there's more than one way of serving society. And you'll see in Karen's novels many themes that point to struggles that humans are having. And she gives us some clues in her books for how to address some of them. So we'll talk about how people can serve in unique ways that don't always involve being a part of a nonprofit activity. Karen, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this. I love the title, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, we thought that it would have that double entendre, you know, heart, which is all about giving and getting to the core of why people do it and what motivates them is also key to what we're trying to do here. So thanks for that. So Karen, you've done a lot in your life. You've been a development professional at a very high level. You've led and managed a consulting business that helps institutions do their work better in a variety of ways. You've trained leaders, and you've also been engaged in teaching at the collegiate level. And more recently, you have taken on a passion that I guess started as a little girl to write novels. And I'm just curious how all of this kind of connects. And, you know, how did you go from a passion as a little girl into a career in nonprofit work? And what's your story? How did you do all this? How did all this come about?
In today's world, you find young people actually choosing development and choosing philanthropy as a profession. But back in the day, I had no idea that it was a profession. And my husband said to me, I had been home taking care of my children, and we had agreed that I would stay home while the children were young. But now the children were both in school, and I was busy running the PTA, and I was running the Bluebirds, and I was helping some guy with a candidacy. And so my husband, Bob, looked at me, and he said, "Karen, you need to take all that energy and all that leadership skills, and you need to find a job."
There you go.
So I fell into my first fundraising job. I just fell into it. But I
what was it? What was it?
I was working for the town of Tarrytown, New York, and the government, I was working for the government of Tarrytown, and they wanted to help the small not-for-profits, mostly serving minorities, you know, black and brown folk, and to help them learn how to write grants to get money from the government, how to be successful. I had no idea how to do that, but I talked myself into the job, and then I learned. I just learned on the job. I went and talked to other people, and so that's how I started. And by the time I got to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute as a director of corporate relations, I was so fortunate. Now, you know Sue Washburn,
correct? Oh, I do. Yeah.
Well, she and Bill McGoldrick became partners, but I worked for Bill back when he was director of development at Rensselaer. And the thing that he taught me that stayed with me forever is about the power of philanthropy, about how it changes, it can change everything, how it can save the world, save people, educate people. And the only thing I knew about giving was to the church and to family. You know, you helped out your neighbors, you helped out your family, you gave to your church. But now he was telling me, no, you invest in education, you invest in not-for-profits. And so I fell in love. I fell in love with this work. And I guess that's the connection to philanthropy and writing, because I've always loved writing. I've always loved reading. I've always loved writing. And so I was so fortunate to have three passions: being a frontline fundraiser, a manager of fundraisers, a teacher of fundraisers, a teacher of CEOs, and to be a writer, a published writer. Who knew that that could happen at this point in my life?
Wow. That's kind of a fascinating story, because in some ways it's consistent with what we hear about people in our sector. You know, they come in, they don't have any particular training to do certain things, but yet they fall in love with either the mission of the organization that they're working in, or something drives them, either because of, you know, how they came about, or maybe they fell into it, in my case. And once you get into it, you sort of fall in love with it. So I just completed an episode with a woman by the name of Cindy Lott, who teaches at Columbia. She actually runs the School of Professional Studies in the Nonprofit Management Program over at Columbia. And we were talking about this professionalization of the nonprofit sector. Obviously something that is truly important, but there still is this conflict that I think sometimes we have. You know, we sort of wonder, if we get too educated, will we lose the passion? And if we're not educated enough, will we actually know what we're doing, and can we accomplish anything? How do you see that balance?
I start with passion, because I don't want, when I'm, like, for instance, if I'm trying to hire somebody, you know, when I was a manager, I wanted to know that they believed in education, because I worked for higher ed. wanted to understand that that's what they, so that's what I'd ask questions about. I'd ask questions about why education, why us? What do you think the impact could be? Because fundraising is so it's not a complicated thing. It has a couple of key components that you have to learn how to do. But if you don't care about the organization, if you don't care about the institution, and if you don't care about philanthropy, if you yourself are not a giver, I wish that every search firm who is looking for a CEO or a high-level position in any not-for-profit, in any institution of education, that one of the questions they would ask is, tell me about the causes you care about. Who do you give to? Who have you volunteered for? Why? Because it's hard to be good at our work if you've never experienced the joy of giving. So I think if you have those two things, then I can teach you. I can teach you the elements because it's not rocket science.
A lot of questions come out of what you said. One of them is, what was it about education that gripped you so much, and higher ed in particular?
When my husband and I came out of, I've known him since I was 13 years old, and he was 14, and we were friends. And we were the children, the second generation of immigrants. And everybody on my block was the second generation of immigrants, of strivers, of people who had come to America, and most of them from the Caribbean, teach their children to have a better life. And they were firemen and policemen, and they worked for the transit. But my dad had a degree from Columbia University. And I can remember Bob and I just sitting there saying, that's our goal. We are going to go to college. We are going to be more like him than like the firemen. And not that there was anything wrong with that. You know, that's a good thing. Thank goodness. But we wanted this other opportunity. And we had to put ourselves through college. We saw what it did for us. We saw that the door opened. We saw that because all of these children of these immigrants all went to college and ended up with good jobs and children that they taught to grow and be. So I think as an African American woman, as an African American man, we both saw education as a door to home ownership, a door to the things that we hope to be able to do in life. So it was easy to care about education, very easy.
And then to try to provide that opportunity for others, obviously, in your work.
Exactly, for lots of others.
So I hear from lots of volunteers who are asked to raise money for nonprofits. My wife just was recently asked to join a board of a nonprofit, and she's never served on a board before. And obviously, one of the first questions is, you know, you have to either give money or you have to get money. And I think we're pretty good with the giving part, but the getting part is something different for her. She's not had to ask anyone for money before. And I know lots of people struggle with that. They don't feel comfortable, for whatever reason, asking people for money. But yet that is key, right, to the success of any organization. You're not going to be able to succeed if you don't want to ask people for money. In your experience, how do people get over that fear or apprehension or whatever it is that's going on in their mind that holds them back?
I was talking to a board, and this woman came up to me and she said, Karen, I have two stacks of money. This stack is the money that I give to the organizations that I care desperately about. Unfortunately, this stack, which is twice as high, is the money I have to give to my friends' organizations because I asked them to give to mine. And what happens when we make it be about solicitation, instead of about building relationships and helping somebody fall in love with the organization before you ask them for money, it turns volunteers and board members off. You want me to, I can remember being asked by the Red Cross to solicit my neighbors on my block. And I said, what's your goal for my block? How much is it? And she told me. I said, here's a check. I wasn't going to go ask my neighbors, even though I believe passionately. But when people understand, so your wife, what I would say to her is, whatever problem the organization she's joining is trying to solve. So the problem that you are trying to solve, Art, is to get people to be more educated about giving and to get organizations to be more accountable. That's the problem you're trying to solve.
Right.
So you invite people to have conversation about that without asking them for money. Give them a chance to fall in love. Give them a chance to get to know. You helped me fall in love with your organization by exposing me to what the story really is, what people are trying to do. This idea that I'm going to just call up somebody, a stranger, and like pitch them and then say, oh, would you give money? Well, that doesn't work very well. Of course you don't want to do it. And that's why so many board members prefer just selling tickets. Tickets to the gala, tickets to the march, tickets to the... because that's easier. But if you really want people to give generously, generously to your organization, you have to do the work that comes before. You have to let them get to know, to care. And then you're not going to get asked back because they're not doing it for you anymore. They're doing it because they believe in the CEO. They believe in the mission and the vision and the values. That's the kind of giving we want.
Excellent. So looking at it from the inside of an organization, and I know a lot of organizations ask me this. One asked me recently, we were on the phone late last night with a group from Japan. And they were asking us, so what do we do to increase the effectiveness of our fundraising efforts internally? You mentioned that fundraising isn't hard from the standpoint of the skill sets, I guess. But what is it that every development team should know in order to be effective? When you see a high-functioning development team, what are you seeing?
First and foremost, the building blocks of the organization have to be in place. The mission has to be clear. The vision has to be compelling. The values have to be clarified and stated. This helps the organization run as well as helps fundraising. The strategic plan has to be in place. The priorities, what am I raising money for and why, has to be clear, that case, the case for investment. So the first and foremost, the building blocks of the organization. The number two, and this will kill you if you're not working on it, is the donor base. Do I have, okay, so there's a number, there's some number that comes out of that work that you say, you know what, we need to raise X and here's why. And you're clear in your mind about that. Well, we have to know, do we have enough prospective donors and donors, corporations, foundations, and individuals to raise that money? And are we taking care of them? Are we thanking them? Are we stewarding them, telling them that this is the impact that your gift had? Are you engaging them? People don't want to be wanted for their money. People want to be wanted for their intellect, for their skills, and there's lots of research to back this. And then, once you have your donor, you're clear about your donor pool and your engagement, then you need your infrastructure in place. Because infrastructure can kill you. Lack of infrastructure can kill you. So you think, okay, I think we have enough donors and we've got our building blocks, but I don't have a software program to manage all of this. I don't have any way to take care of this. I don't have a board in place with the right makeup, the right composition, a strategically composed board. I don't have enough staff. You know, one person is doing everything, and therefore they're doing nothing really well. But The last one is the other one that gets people. Do you have the will to do the work, the implementation, all the plans, all the names and the lists, all the pieces? But if your board isn't interested, if your CEO isn't interested, if you don't have a culture of philanthropy where everybody co-owns what we're trying to accomplish, everybody believes in it, then it's really hard to get anything done. So I would say will. Do you know the work of Jim Collins?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, and one of the things he said that was so important about a CEO of a not-for-profit, because he wrote, after he wrote his book for the for-profit world, he wrote a little small pamphlet for the not-for-profit world. And he said it was humility, the will to get things done, and the ability to get others to follow, that you have no power over, that you have no... Doesn't that describe your job?
It absolutely does, and it has for the last 30 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely does.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of times we look at nonprofits and we think, oh, this is a great organization, and when it came into existence, it must have had everything it needed to thrive. But they don't realize that, no, it didn't just fall out of the sky. Somebody said, we're going to do this, when probably all the odds were against it succeeding. And they said, we're going to get the right people engaged, as you're mentioning here. And they were able to do that. And over time, built an organization. So I certainly don't disagree with you, and I couldn't agree with you more, that nonprofit organizations, really like businesses, you know, they come from a compelling case and from people who won't be denied, you know, who have this will that you're talking about to succeed. They're not, you know, these great business plans that are laid out. In fact, if you had a business plan to create a nonprofit, you'd probably say, forget about it. At some point, you need a business plan, but usually that's not when it starts. You know,
that's not where it starts.
No. So continuing this interesting, really interesting conversation with you, Karen, I can't help but want to ask you to connect now your work as a professional inside of an organization to how you expanded to become more of a consultant to organizations and to essentially start your own business and serve philanthropy in that fashion.
So here comes Bob again. You remember Bob from earlier?
I got to meet Bob. I can't wait to meet him.
I had one president too many. I worked for one president too many. I had lots of wonderful presidents, but my last president was not a fit. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? What, you know, what can I do next? And Bob said, Karen, hang out your shingle. I'm telling you, both of us don't want to be 50 years old working for somebody else. So he had already stepped away and started a business. Mm-hmm. And I said, hang out my shingle? What are you talking about? Like, how would I get paid? And how would people know? And he said, Karen, I'm telling you, you hang your shingle and they will come.
Wow.
And I was afraid. I was afraid. I was so used to working in higher ed where it's a kinder, gentler nation.
Yeah.
You know, you're well cared for there. There are great benefits. Oh, my goodness, the benefits were amazing. And the work was good. And now he's saying, you know, work for yourself. But I stepped out on faith. I stepped out on believing in my husband and believing in the good Lord. And I hung my shingle. And I'll tell you, Art, I never missed a payday.
Wow. Who was your first client?
It was Teachers College, Columbia. And Arthur Levine was the president. And he and I are still good personal friends, 22 years later. And through many things, he got me to be on his next job and on his board. And now he and I are both novelists. together.
Wow.
Yes. But he was my first client. And he tells people this story all the time. He says, the reason I like Karen is because I told her I wanted to raise $125 million. And she said, that's not enough.
Wow.
And he said, and we raised $155 million in that campaign because Karen believed, because she believed, and I decided to believe her.
Wow.
So one of my favorite stories. It's one of his favorite stories, and it's one of my favorite stories as well. So they were my first client, and they stayed a client for a good 10 years.
Wow. That's fantastic. I know a lot of people would love to have a 10-year client in the consulting business. So you obviously knew what you were doing. So in your experience, what type of challenges do you deal with when you come across a client in development? What are some of the key problems that they're hiring you to help them with?
I would say that the Osborne Group is most proud of being capacity builders. And when you look at all the issues that they want to campaign, or they're trying to build the top end of their pyramid, you know, their major donor program, or they need board development, or whatever it is, whatever the issue is, when we look at it, we think they want to level up. And we have to figure out ways to build capacity that's sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just go in and help people raise money and then you walk away, it's very hard for them to keep that going.
Yeah.
And our job is to work our way out of a job. That's our job. One of the reasons Teachers College stayed our client for 10 years is because we were working on different things. It would break my heart, literally break my heart, if we hadn't built in that resiliency, that sustainability, making sure that the infrastructure, the human and otherwise infrastructure was in place. So I think that's the most important thing, and then not to do anything in a cookie cutter way, because everybody, so it's kind of funny. So everybody starts out by saying they're different and special, and that's both true and not. So when they say that, they say, well, you know, we're different, we're special. And I listen carefully, but I've heard their problems before. On the other hand, everybody is different and special. And you do have to tailor things so that it works with the personalities, it works with the needs. But that's how almost everybody starts. They say, well, you know, we're not like anybody else. Okay, tell me about it.
So there are lots of different ways of giving and serving. You know, you did it as a professional inside of an organization and as a consultant to nonprofits and mostly colleges. But we can also do this in other ways through art, through arts. We see that there are many people who create things, create artworks, create books that also in many ways serve and educate and inspire and help people in different ways. It's not always necessary that we do this in the form of a nonprofit. I'm trying to understand from you, Karen, if Kara, this fictional character that you created in your first book, was somehow inspired by the work that you were doing. Did she in any way lead you? Does she call you to serve society in any particular way?
Oh, I love that question. I just want to correct two things.
Okay.
The Osborne Group does at least 50% not-for-profits.
Yeah.
And it's global.
Okay.
Okay. So thank you about asking about Kara. And I would get so angry watching the media, watching movies and television shows, where people who had been sexually abused or physically abused as children are now the murderers the criminals and they say, well, you know, the reason they will like this bad guy, this horrible, evil person, is because of what happened to them as children. When 99% of us, myself included, we don't hurt anybody. We just hurt ourselves. I wanted to write a story that wasn't about abuse, but I wanted to write a story where my protagonist was a survivor. So the story's focus isn't the abuse, but the story's, but that's who she is. That's part of who she is. And that was the original impetus, was to show that we're not all out there killing other people and abusing other people. It's true that most abusers have been abused, but it's not true that most of the abused turn out to be abusers. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to write a page turner.
You did.
And I also believe so much in the power of forgiveness. And so that's a theme in all three of my novels. A big theme is forgiveness.
Mm.
And every single time for the 4 years that Getting It Right was out, every single book talk, every single book signing, somebody would come up to me at the end. They'd wait until everybody was gone. And then they'd say, can I speak to you? This happened every single time. And then they would say, it happened to me. It happened to me. And for some, they said they'd never told anybody before. They'd never said it out loud before. That just filled my heart.
Yeah, I know it does. And mine too. There are just so many Karas out there, so many untold stories, so many people who carry this burden, you know, this feeling that somehow they did something wrong or there's something wrong with them because of what happened to them. And it's just, I would suspect, damaging and debilitating. It weighs on their spirits, I would assume. And how do you relieve that? How do you shake that burden and that pain? And, you know, it takes, I guess, forgiveness to do that, doesn't it?
It does, although that's the last step.
Yeah.
You know, when they talk about the journey.
Yep.
And I remember the first time my therapist mentioned that, and I said, forgive? Oh, no. Nope. There'll be no forgiving here, you know.
Yeah.
No.
Understandably so.
When I went to my parents' graves and sat down and had a talk with them, that was my purpose. And I think people also think forgiveness is absolution, and it's not. It doesn't absolve people of the bad things they do. It just lets it go from your heart. It just lets all the pain and the sorrow and the ache. But there's work, just like in fundraising. There's a whole lot of work that goes into that joyful, inspired, generous yes when you ask for a gift. There's a whole lot of work that goes up until that moment when you say, you know what? I'm letting this go. I forgive them, and I'm letting this go.
And you get the joy back in your life.
Yes, that's exactly right. Because there's no room for joy when you're carrying all that hate and pain and anger and misery in you. And also, you know, the other thing that children do is they numb themselves. So you numb yourself so that you don't feel, that you don't think about. But of course, you're numbing your ability to feel joy and love as well. Yes, I love that you shape this question, as there's so many ways to serve. Because I do think that I have... That's a thread in my life, was to find different ways to serve. You know, I'm a volunteer, I'm a philanthropist, I'm a writer.
Well, you know, again, this podcast is about helping people understand that there's joy in giving and serving. And, you know, for someone like yourself who has experienced that pain, is it also true that maybe you saw giving and serving as a way to empower yourself, as a way to find joy.
Yes, indeed. I think joyful, inspired, generous giving fills you up. I was speaking at a hospital, and there were doctors in the room. And this doctor raised his hand and he said, "Miss Osborne, I just have to tell you that I think this giving thing is unethical. That you would even ask me as a doctor to turn my patients in to the development office. It's just a terrible thing." So I paused and I turned to the group and I said, "Has anyone in this room ever made a significant gift? Has anybody here ever given?" So this doctor raised her hand and I said, "Would you tell us about it?" And so she told us what the situation was. And I said, "And how did you feel when you said yes?" And she said, "I felt rich. I felt rich. I knew I wasn't rich, but I felt rich. I felt this joyful feeling that I was rich and enriched." And so that was the only way to counter. I wasn't going to argue with him. You know, I just let him hear from a colleague about the joy of giving. And that kind of goes back to our earlier conversation that if we don't have people in our not-for-profits who have personally experienced the joy of service, who have personally experienced the joy of giving, and you don't have to be rich to be generous. And that's, I never say that, you know, I talk about people being generous because that's what we're really looking for.
Yeah.
Generous with their ideas, generous with their time, generous with their resources, generous with their kindness.
So let me pick up on that just a little bit, because I believe that you're talking about people who could be in almost any situation, but they can find joy when they give something away, no matter how small it is, right? I mean, it's empowering to say that, you know, my situation is tough, but I took something I had and helped somebody else so that maybe they might have a little, you know, a little joy in their day. I think that's what you're saying. And I really believe that we're at a somewhat of a crossroads, Karen, in our country, because the numbers are not trending in favor of what we're talking about. And I don't know if you've been following this, but a recent study showed that since between 2000 and 2018, the percentage of families that are giving to philanthropic organizations declined from 68% to 49.5%. And I'm slightly off. It's 66% to 49.5% during that 18-year period. And I'm wondering what could possibly be going on the one hand, but I'm also feeling that people are missing out on a major way of experiencing the joy that we're talking about. This isn't all about what happens to the thing you give to or the person that you give to. It's about you too as a giver. It's about you too. It's selfish in some ways, right? I mean, I don't think people truly understand the power associated with taking something that you have and giving it away to someone else. And I don't know what has to happen. I've just joined this thing called the Generosity Commission, and we're going to be looking into some of the causes and trying to recommend some policy changes in our country. But without this, I don't know what we become as a country, and I don't know what happens to our humanity.
Yeah, That is so beautifully stated. I think there's a lot of reasons why that number has gone down, and one of them is that right in the middle of that was the Great Recession. It was just a terrible time in our country. I also think that not-for-profits, this has been happening over time, have been focused so much at the high end. Mm-hmm. You know, $471+ billion given last year in the middle of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. But when you look and see, you know, everything is concentrated, and we've forgotten the middle.
That's right.
We've forgotten the middle. We do all right on the bottom, but we've forgotten all those people in the middle because we're so focused on the richest, the mm-hmm. big gifts mm-hmm. That we're not. So part of it's our fault.
Yeah.
That we are, and another part that I think is part of our fault is that we don't spend enough time letting people know that they made a difference and that they matter. Part of that joy, there is that initial joy of just helping somebody. But then there's that second joy, that pew joy, when that somebody comes back and says to you, I just want to tell you, Karen, I just want to let you know, Art, that when you said that, this is how it changed things for me. And I wanted to thank you again. When you gave that, this is what we did with it. That's the rush. Mm-hmm. The first rush is just you did something selfless.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, right.
But the second rush comes that what we did mattered.
Yeah.
It made a difference. And if not for profit, so when you were talking on your generosity commission.
Yeah.
If we could just help not-for-profits realize how important it is, let our churches realize. You know, so many of our churches ask for money as a responsibility.
Yeah.
And don't take the time to remember that these are human beings, and you don't want people just giving out of obligation.
Absolutely not, right.
You want people giving joyfully.
Joyfully.
And so we need all of our institutions to let people know that not only was it appreciated, thank you, but that it actually mattered. Something changed. Something changed. And then the joy will be there. The joy, and it's catching. Because, of course, what do? We tell other people. Let me tell you about this really wonderful experience I had. And we do the other too. When it's not a good experience, we tell other people. So.
Absolutely. Well, Karen, you know, we are probably getting to the end of this, but I wanted you to tell us about some of the good fortune that has happened to you as a result of your foray into noveling. And I know you wrote a second novel. And I understand you have a third one that has been contracted for. So what's your second novel? Tell us the name of it.
It's called Tangled Lies, and it's a murder mystery. And unlike Getting It Right, where my protagonists were 30, in this one, my protagonist is 70. And I always try to have multicultural. Everybody in my stories are, you know, they're black folks and white folks and Latinas and Asian. I like to demonstrate that we can all work together sometimes. And so Tangled Lies is a murder mystery. And then Reckonings, which comes out in June, is another suspense story and another kind of family saga. And this is like such a gift to happen at this point in my life, and this point in my career. You're never too old to dream and for dreams to come true.
Well, continue to tell your stories, because I know from reading that you're also serving us. The themes that you're uncovering, that you're speaking to people. You're speaking to people who are going through things and maybe saying to them, it's okay. You know, it's a tough time, but you're not unusual. There are others out there and there's nothing wrong with you. You can rise above this if you choose to, and with help from others. And there'll be others out there who will help you. So thank you.
Couldn't have said it better.
Thank you for what you do. Well, this is the Heart of Giving podcast. I've been, you know, really blessed to have this conversation with you, Karen Osborne. And I wish you continued success in everything that you do. Thank you for everything you've done. And I look forward to our continuing to work together.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. And I hope you'll listen to other episodes by just going to any of the major podcast platforms. You can also follow us and subscribe on Patreon if you want to make a donation, patreon.com. And also make a comment on, especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love to get a favorable review on Apple Podcasts because that helps us to build audience. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.